mathematically, there can't be more than one end of a candle. Bottom of the ninth, can't find my socks. That's Modern Baseball. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. Mathematically, the Jays had a big impact on that National League wildcard race this weekend, dropping 2 of 3 to the Braves, including an 11th inning decision on Sunday, which, bottom of the ninth, Chad Green blows his third consecutive save opportunity after being perfect for the season before last week. Zach Pop and some bad defense do the Jays away in the bottom of the 11th after George Springer had come through with an RBI single in the top of that inning. Solid day for Yariel Rodriguez, five innings of basically one mistake ball, a 90-mile-an-hour sinker that didn't really get off the plate to Jared Kelenic that he took for a ride. Spencer Horwitz with another big day, pinch hitting for a home run in the eighth, coming up with another hit in extra innings. Horwitz, of course, had a four-hit, two-home run game on Saturday as well. And as much as I understand the lefty-lefty, hey, Chris Sale is death on lefties, we're going to try to stack eight righties in the lineup. Little surprised to not see Horwitz in there Sunday, but this is why he comes in a favorable pinch hit situation. By the way, the bottom of the Jays order when they go righty heavy in that game, so much less threatening than the lefties in their lineup that Brian Snicker, the Braves manager, didn't do what you'd normally do and go to a righty out of the bullpen when you're heading into a righty, 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 righty chunk of the order. He used a lefty there because he'd rather Schneider, De Los Santos, Servin, etc., hit with the platoon advantage, then bring in a righty, chase those guys out of the game, and then lefties come in. Now, the fact that the game extended on as it did and remained close, Snicker probably made a mistake there, because I think what you probably would have rather have done is bring in the righty there, get the Jays to make their substitutions, bring in all those lefties, and then the next time through the order, if the game is still close, the game's still at hand, then you bring in your lefty-on-lefty reliever, and the Jays have nobody to go to on the bench. Anyway, even though Brian Snicker has not had the best handful of weeks here and obviously playing with a very shortened deck given all the injuries that the Braves have dealt with, they still take 2 of 3 in that series. Elsewhere, the Mets took 2 of 3 in their series. So the Mets and Braves remain tied as the Mets now arrive in Toronto for a three-game set. So the Jays are going to once again have an impact on that National League wildcard race. That National League wildcard race, which, by the way, now more distinctly includes the Padres and the Diamondbacks. Neither of those teams have played particularly well. So the Braves and Mets are only a game and a half back of the Diamondbacks, two games back of the Padres. We very much have four teams now racing for these three spots rather than what it looked like a week ago, which was, can the Mets catch the Braves? Lots of Jays stuff to talk about from this weekend as well, including the Yariel Rodriguez performance. Let's talk to Shai Davidi of Sportsnet, who was down there. Shai, how are we doing this morning? Shai, how are we doing this morning?
Blake, you got me?
Now I got you. How are you?
I'm okay, dude. How are you?
I'm good, now that we got that settled out. So I do want to talk about the games from this weekend, but I think headline item this morning, and if anyone goes to sportsnet.ca, they can see a terrific piece that you wrote. You sat down with Bo Bichette before he heads out on a rehab assignment here. Talk to him about what the time down has been like, what his future looks like. Give us the headline item, and then let's dig into this a little bit. How's Bo Bichette doing these days?
Well, from a physical perspective, he's feeling good, feeling confident, and very much excited about getting out on the rehab assignment. And as we talked about his time away from the team, the thing that really stuck out was the way that he said that, you know, during the trade deadline, he was forced to consider his future as all the speculation was swirling around him. And he really feels like he wants to play with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. forever, wants to do that with the Blue Jays, and wants to win a championship with them. And this is something that the two of them have been talking about together since they were teenagers in low A ball in the Blue Jay system, and something that they've reiterated to one another every year since. And you know, that now that his contract is on the verge of expiring, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is on the verge of free agency. This trade deadline, I think, really drove that home to Bo Bichette that this may not be forever, and he hopes that that will certainly be the case.
Well, for anyone who hasn't seen the piece yet and isn't watching on TV, the quote is, "When I had time to think about what I want, basically, my ultimate goal really is to play with Vladdy forever, to win a championship with him, and to do that with this organization. I'm 100% committed to doing whatever it takes to accomplish those things. That's where I'm at." So, great quote. I mean, that is a great quote for Twitter. That is a great quote for our show. And Shai, a great piece there. When you kind of touched on it a little bit there, this time down, not only the trade deadline where there was speculation, and obviously Bo was asked about, you know, his future in San Francisco and was pretty honest about, like, well, I can't control things, et cetera. How illuminating do you think this time away was for him, like not being in there every day and, like you said, being forced to kind of zoom out and look at this stuff from a perspective that isn't living in it day to day the way you do when you're healthy?
Yeah, I think that was definitely part of it, that he had time to think, and there was obviously a lot going on. You think about the number of deals that the Blue Jays made, and I think he understood that it was incredibly unlikely that he was going to be traded unless another club really forced the Blue Jays' hand with a deal they simply couldn't refuse, and under the circumstances, that wasn't going to happen. But at the same time, whenever you're forced to face something, and it's actually real, it's not just speculative, then, you know, it hits in a different way. And that's certainly the impression that I had during the conversation with Bo, that he ended up just doing a lot of thinking. There was also a lot of reflecting about his own season and how things played out for him and his role in how things didn't turn out the way the Blue Jays had hoped this year, and how he wants to make a difference, not just if he's able to get back for a couple of weeks or whatever it is this year, but also into next year and beyond that. So there was a lot more reflection than just about his contract situation. But obviously he was home during the deadline as all that was playing out. And so that certainly made it top of mind in a way that it's never been for him before.
So in situations like this, and look, we're a year and change before you can hit free agency, so it's not imminent, although we all understand you would love the certainty of having that figured out with Vladimbo's long-term status this winter. Bo and the organization would have conversations about this stuff. I'm sure the organization is aware of how Bo feels, and they've had those conversations with his reps. But how important is a statement like this from Bo, and just that the fact that Bo actually feels that way, rather than heading into a winter where maybe there is a level of uncertainty there and the Jays have to decide what to do with Bo Bichette contractually or trade-wise, without that knowledge, you know, I guess from the org's perspective, how helpful is it that Bo feels this way and feels this way firmly enough to put it out there publicly to you?
Well, look, if whenever these types of deals happen, right, you need both the team and the player want to commit to one another, right? It's hard to find value. It's hard to find shared risk and all those different elements where both sides feel like they're getting a good deal and they're being fair to themselves and to the market. But if you don't have that piece, then you just can't bridge gaps, right? You have to have a bit of trust there. And so I don't know that this should necessarily surprise people because, Bo's never come out and said, oh, I want to be traded or anything along those lines. But there has been a lot of gossip in the industry, a lot of speculation in the industry about Bo's intentions at the end of his free agency, how he felt about his time and being in Toronto and all those kinds of things. And essentially this is Bo Bichette going to say, hey, you know, like this, if it's not coming out of my mouth, then you shouldn't believe it. And so this is what, if I'm going to say what I want, and that's what you should believe. And here he is putting it out there. So that's certainly helpful, but this is bigger than just one contract between, say, Bo Bichette or Vladimir Guerrero Jr., right? Like, given the numbers that it's going to take to get deals with both of those players, this is a long-term strategic decision about the way that this team is going to operate. Because if you're extending both those guys, you're really committing yourself and saying, yeah, we're not rebuilding anytime soon. We're going to keep pushing in. You've got to spend commensurately around them in order to leverage their best years, which are really coming up for both players. So there's a wider discussion and a much bigger decision that needs to be made first. But this is obviously a really important step in that, you know, his wants are pretty clear, and that's, you know, for him and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. to be the long-term cornerstones for this franchise.
Which would be nice, but like you said, there is a real strategic component to that of, obviously, you know, we've framed the trade deadline and what they've done, and the moves have telegraphed this. They want to compete again in 2025. They think they can. But 2026 and beyond is a bit more of a question mark with how many guys they have reaching free agency, the state of the farm system, et cetera. So, yes, like you said, big strategic decisions to make on the part of the Blue Jays from here. But nice to know that Bo Bichette would like to stick around and be that 1-2 with Vlad. Last one on Bo for you, Shai, before we move on to another topic. He is expected to join AAA Buffalo for a rehab assignment beginning tomorrow. Would we expect to see him back this weekend, or is this going to be a lengthier rehab? What was the latest on that?
So John Schneider suggested it'd be 4 or 5 games, okay, which, I mean, maybe could get him back for the end of the Cardinals series this weekend, but just reading between the lines, I would guess that he joins the Blue Jays in Texas next week when they open a series there. But, I mean, who knows, right? Maybe Bo gets into a couple games, performs really well, and is comfortable enough, and he's back Friday for the start of that series against St. Louis. But I could also see the Blue Jays exercising extra caution here just because it's already been a couple times that he's aggravated that calf this year.
Yeah, so he'll spend the week booming out in South Gwinnett like Lou will, as the lyric goes. That's where Buffalo is on the road. Shai, another good piece you wrote coming out. You were just pumping it out this weekend. The Jordan Romano stuff, really good piece on you on Yariel Rodriguez's outing Sunday. Yariel was quite good on Sunday. 1 run over 5 innings. Only went to 73 pitches as the Jays kind of, you know, be mindful of it, of his workload here. What did you make of this nice step forward for Yariel coming off of a couple of iffier ones?
Yeah, I mean, for me right now, the most interesting thing about him is just how the workload gets managed. And obviously, yeah, the Blue Jays want to see him pitch well and establish some things. And, you know, he's really learning about starting because he hasn't done this consistently in about 4 or 5 years. And he's essentially going to be wire to wire as a starter this year with a interruption on the injured list. And he's doing that at the big league level. So there's a lot of learning about adjustments, his stuff, how it varies, what he has to do on days when he's feeling better than usual, days that he's not feeling as well as he can. And that, to me, is the key piece here, because his innings count is quite literally gone, you know, 0 to 100, right? He's at about 94 innings. Presumably he'll end up around 100 by the time, just a bit over 100 at season's end. He didn't pitch in organized games last year as he was working through his contract and citizenship situation. And so this is, in a lot of ways, the baseline workout that allows him to potentially jump forward into a spot in the rotation next year. And I think what he's shown are some flashes this year where you're like, okay, this could work. And then there are times where you're like, well, when it goes bad, it really goes bad. And so can he smooth that out a little bit next year and you know, get to, say, 150 innings or something along those lines? That's a huge pivot decision for the Blue Jays, because yeah, if they're going to count on him in the rotation, that really impacts how they're shopping in the offseason.
Yeah, and you kind of went into the numbers in this piece. He's at 93.2 innings for this year across AAA and the majors, and then he didn't throw competitively last year. He threw, but not in any way we can track. And then prior to that, it was 54 innings, 96 innings, 94 innings as a reliever / swingman. In Japan, you have to go back to the 2018 Cuban Winter Series when he threw 133 innings for his career high. So it's been a minute. Now, within that, he gave you some pretty good insight through translator Hector LeBron coming out of that start as well, and said specifically, we accomplished the plan that we had since the beginning. And he was talking to you about, you know, that carryover into 2025, his confidence into 2025. What do you, like, is the, you just kind of said it, it'll dictate a little bit what the organization is going to do in terms of starting pitching depth. But I would imagine it'll be like at this point in the season, Yariel is probably only going to throw another 15 innings or so. So how do the Jays approach the offseason from a starting pitching standpoint? Like, I think Bowden has probably played his way enough in there that you're reasonably confident, but there are, you know, between Bowden, Yariel, Jake Bloss, a bunch of guys who are injured or have been injured, still some question marks at the back of the rotation there.
Yeah, and also, I think there are a lot of lessons from this year, right? Yeah. But one that sticks out is that, and it's like so cliche to say, but it's just so true. Like, you just never have enough pitching,
never.
Right? And we've seen that play out over the last couple of years where you're like, okay, the Blue Jays have good starting depth and they have enough guys to get through the season. Then all of a sudden you're in the middle of the year and they're scrambling and it's a challenge. And so, you know, they've got a good base to work off of with Berríos, Gausman, and Chris Bassitt. And then you mentioned Bowden Francis and Yariel Rodriguez and Jake Bloss. Alek Manoah should potentially be ready to return sort of late July, early August, kind of like Hyunjin Ryu did a couple seasons ago and contribute to the team. But is that enough? You know, what do you do if there is an injury? And the Blue Jays have been incredibly fortunate with their big three, that the reliability of Gausman, Berríos, and Bassitt is such an incredible asset. I don't think that can be stated enough. But do they need to get another arm in there just so that you can have some flexibility? Do you maybe look for another swingman type to put in your bullpen so you have someone who can jump into the rotation if you need, you know, someone who could do what Ross Stripling did for the team a few years back? There are a few ways to kind of go about it, but I think ultimately the Blue Jays will want to get more starting depth, but they also need to rebuild their bullpen. They also need to augment their offense. So there's only so much that you can do over the course of a single winter. And that's why that some of the decisions in terms of, okay, what do we have internally, and then how do we best augment? That's really the crux of, or going to be the basis of whether or not they succeed next year.
Yeah, and that's where you can get into, you know, okay, do you address starting pitching even though it's a strength of the team on paper at the top end of the rotation? Because if you have too many starters, then that addresses the bullpen. Whereas if you go out and spend $100 million on your bullpen and you have a starter injury, that doesn't really help you. You know, Tanner Scott or pick your reliever of choice can't fill in as a starter. Whereas, you know, who knows, maybe I think they're pretty clear they want Yariel to start, but theoretically he loses out on a rotation spot. Well, there's your multi-inning bullpen guy because you've addressed the starter depth. The other question that there is in the bullpen as you build it for, and this is for the pitching staff as a whole and budget, it's something you wrote about on, I believe, Friday, Shai. Jordan Romano is not going to make it back this season. He has a year left of arbitration control, but it's going to be a pretty pricey ARB number coming off of an injured year. What do you make of that aspect of it? Are we headed for potentially, you know, a scenario where it makes sense for both sides to, hey, forget arbitration, let's work on something multi-year that takes away some of the 2025 risk for and then some of the future risk for Mono? Like, what do you make of that kind of $8+ million ARB number sitting there for an injured closer?
Yeah, and that's it's a big one, right? Because the Blue Jays can't have that much money be inefficient for them in the bullpen next year, given the scope of their need, right? Like, in theory, you would have told me coming into this season that Jordan Romano would have been down for a while. You would have looked at it and said, okay, well, there's Jimmy Garcia, and there's Chad Green, and there's Eric Swanson, and there's Tim Mesa. The Blue Jays should be able to withstand that. But obviously we know how the season has played out, and that didn't turn out to be the case. So the Blue Jays have to rebuild the bullpen in a pretty significant way. And that can be expensive. That's volatile. And certainly if Jordan Romano is right, you're not going to do much better than that for the money. But the fact that he wasn't able to get back, does that create some questions for the Blue Jays about what he is next year, and that he essentially fought through elbow pain from spring training right through to the end of the year, and his recovery from the surgery to alleviate an impingement didn't seemingly, or at least the recovery from that has taken longer than expected. And so what does that mean? I don't know. Obviously I'm not privy to those medical files, but is that a question? That's a question for the Blue Jays to ask themselves. And so, yeah.
We have lost connection with Shai Davidi there. Yeah, it's an interesting question with Jordan Romano. I think, well, thank you to Shai for coming on. We were close to wrapping up with Shai there anyway. So thank you to him. And yeah, make sure you check out sportsnet.ca for all of Shai's good stuff from throughout the weekend. There was obviously a great conversation with Bo Bichette, an interesting look at the Jordan Romano situation and through the lens of all the work the Jays have to do on their bullpen. Some good Yariel Rodriguez notes coming out of yesterday's start as well. The other thing, and this was via tweets from Shai and Arden over the weekend, Aurelvis Martinez made his return to AAA on the weekend. He had two doubles. He played third base, which is interesting given that they had moved him over to second for the most part. We do have Shai back here. Shai, welcome back. Last one before I let you go proper here. Aurelvis back at AAA. It seemed like from the way that you and Arden worded your tweets about Aurelvis's return to AAA, despite being eligible to come back September 23rd or September 24th, not in the mix for the majors, but maybe headed for some winter ball?
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. Either winter ball, the small potential, maybe it's Arizona Fall League too. The Blue Jays definitely want to keep him playing, but I don't think that it's going to be at the big leagues once the suspension expires and the AAA season is over.
Yeah, which will be, you know, winter ball's good. We were all asking John Schneider about winter ball stuff the other week too. Obviously, Bowden Francis had some success down there as well. And yeah, we're about 2 weeks from where Arizona Fall League rosters normally come out. Shai, last one before I let you go. I fibbed. I'm gonna sneak one more in here. Spencer Horwitz had another big weekend at the plate. He's up to 12 homers now in 80 games at the major league level, in addition to 16 doubles. The 28 extra base hits in 80 games is, even as a doubles hitter at the minor league level, it's a little more power than was projected from Spencer Horwitz. What have you made of that aspect of his game since he's come up?
Yeah, it's super interesting, right? Because it's something that he's been consciously trying to do, and not in a way where he's fishing for it, but there are times in certain counts, certain opportunities where he's looking to sort of get his best swing off and do some damage. And so that's a bit different from his traditional game where it's based around contact and plate discipline, and it's still maintaining that element of it. But when there are opportunities in certain counts to perhaps attack a pitch and try to ambush it and do some damage with it, that he's looking for his spots. And he's really an interesting hitter because of the way that he's constantly able to make adjustments to what he's seeing from opponents. You know, just this weekend, he made an adjustment. He felt against the Phillies that his hands were coming around the ball too far from his body, and that led to some bad pull contact. And so he and Matt Hague put together a drill that they'd used in the past to get his hands tighter to his body. And he felt that that was a key difference in some of the swings that he got off this weekend. So it's really intriguing to watch him play the chess game and oftentimes win the chess game against opposition pitchers.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. And it's one of those things where when you show that capacity to figure things out and add new layers, I'm going to have a little bit more patience or belief the next time a cold stretch comes around that you can continue to figure things out at that level. So it's pretty interesting when you draw up the potential lineups for next year to just how much power Spencer Horwitz has been able to add since getting the call up. Shai, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning. Great work all weekend.
Yeah, appreciate it. Have a great week, Blake.
Shai Davidi of Sportsnet. Again, check out all those pieces at sportsnet.ca. Yariel stuff, Bo stuff, Jordan Romano stuff, a lot of good stuff there. And then, yeah, we'll be tracking Aurelvis Martinez at the AAA level over these last 2 weeks of the season. And, yeah, down on the farm, by the way, we won't know Arizona Fall League. I don't know. Maybe they'll leak, but it was September 22nd last year we got the Arizona Fall League roster. So 6 to 8 players the Jays will want to get extended run. A couple guys turn that into, you know, sometimes it happens where it's nothing. Sometimes it happens where it helps launch a guy. You know, Will Robertson is built off of that for a strong AAA season. We talked to Damiano Pomeggiani about it last week and, you know, how that's kind of helped him. And then a lot of times it's guys who just miss too much time due to injury. You want to get the innings load up, the plate appearance load up. There are a lot of good weekends around the farm system, by the way. Alan Roden and Josh Kasevich have stayed hot at AAA. Stuart Burrow has been really, really good since he went back down. Gilberto Batista, who the Jays picked up in the Danny Jansen trade has been a little bit better than maybe advertised at A-ball there. Kendry Rojas continues to look good since he's come back from injury. Grant Rogers had a really good start. We'll check in on the farm system a little bit more over these last 2 weeks. Some of the leagues have wrapped up. AAA wraps up on the 21st or 22nd, whatever it is. But yeah, some interesting stuff going on down there. Maybe we'll talk to some prospect people later in the week. Right now, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk to our favorite pitching analyst, Lance Brozdowski. We'll talk a little about Bowden Francis, who is scheduled to start tomorrow. Jays haven't announced their probables yet, but it's scheduled to be Bassett, Bowden Francis, and then either Kevin Gausman on regular rest, or given their desire to keep guys on a little extra rest down the stretch here, maybe that's a bullpen day. Jake Bloss lined up to start tomorrow at AAA, but they could juggle there as well. Let's take a break. We'll talk to Lance Brozdowski about pitching on the other side as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network at Sportsnet 360.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays dropped 2 of 3 to the Braves. They'll now play the Mets, the Toronto Blue Jays, the most important team in the National League wildcard race. Let's talk pitching. Let's talk to our favorite pitching analyst. He is at Lance Broz on Twitter, on Substack, on YouTube. One of the absolute best going, Lance Brozdowski. Lance, good morning, man. How are we doing?
What's up, Blake? How are you, man?
Good. So clarify this for me. Are you a Bears fan, or you just happen to do football stuff also while in Chicago?
Yeah, so I help out a little bit with like some video editing and producing in the off season just to keep me like full time at the network and stuff. But I'm a mercenary, man. I play fantasy football, so I really don't have a team. But I am rooting for the Bears this year, obviously. There's alignment between if them they do well and we get more eyes on our coverage, et cetera. But I wouldn't consider myself a Bears fan if that you're directly asking me.
Yeah, I mean, hey, look, the mercenary thing is a good approach. It's football's the best for that. Is like, yeah, I care about fantasy. You know, when I was younger, I'm going to play Madden. And then, yeah, there's one team that'll get like slight priority over red zone, maybe. That's exactly. Probably the sanest approach to it. Okay, well, glad your Bears got a win yesterday and you got some eyes on your video editing there. A lot of eyes on your baseball work as well, of course. And I do want to talk to you about two bigger videos you had in the last 2 weeks here. Before we do that, wanted to do our regular Bowden Francis check-in. Think this is the third time you've come on the show this year. Once it was like, Bowden Francis is struggling, but we liked him. What's going on? Second time it was like, Bowden Francis figured out the splitter. This looks good. And now we're coming off of a really, really strong month or so since we last chatted. What are you seeing with Bowden Francis during this inarguably the most successful stretch of his career?
Yeah, he's been on a bit of a heater, I think, overall, more than I almost thought he would. But, I mean, I remember when we first talked about him early this season, my main knock was that I just didn't think the curveball was like a primary non-fastball pitch for him. I just generally don't like curveballs as non-fastball primaries, like throwing them a ton, especially when they're only like 75 to 77. So he moved off that, and he went, obviously, we talked about this in the past, like he added a sinker, he went to more slider splitter. The splitter in particular, I really think, is kind of threading the whole repertoire together. I feel like a lot of the times when I look at splitters and stuff, models and stuff, they're not necessarily captured in the proper way. Whereas a lot of the time they're working really well as offhanded. So he's righty throwing to left-handed hitters. It works really well as a weapon in that direction. And then because splitters are generally platoon neutral, you could throw them versus right-handed hitters as well. So that pitch has really, I think, come together for him. And it's just worked. And I think the other kind of peripheral pieces make sense. I still wouldn't even say the slider's like a great pitch, but it's working in the context when he needs it. But it's been a really impressive run here. I've seen some stats. I'm sure you've used them. I'm gonna misquote them here, but essentially, like his three start run he had at the earlier in the month was matched only by like Kershaw, DeGrom, and some other random pitcher over the last like 20 years or something like that. So it's been really impressive to see. I got a chance to talk to him when you guys were out here in Chicago, and he's a really funny guy. Like, yeah. I had a funny story where he like, there's not a lot of times where you get asked to like sit down for an interview in a locker room. So I like walk in there. I just like want to chat with him because I knew all these changes and stuff. And he like asks me to sit down. And I was like, what are you talking about? And he was like, no, just sit down. Like we could chat. And I was like, okay. Yeah. This is very non-standard, I think. It makes sense if you're in a dugout or something like that and you sit with someone. But in a locker room, in visiting locker room, you know, in Wrigley Field, and all these chairs are lined up and I'm like sitting at someone's locker. I don't even remember whose locker it was. But we had a great convo. Like, he was just a very I don't know. He's just a very personable guy. So I have a soft spot for him now, apart from the pitching, because he's an unbelievable pitcher.
Yeah, it's great. I've enjoyed getting to know him as well. He was on the show last year when he was down in AAA, which was a lot of fun. Yeah, really, really cool to see this. And the team feels the same way about him that you and I do. Those guys really get behind him. With respect to where things can go from here for Bowden Francis, so the splitter is fairly well established now, given, you know, what we know about stabilization points and when we know a pitch is solid or not. Does he need to still at some point get more velocity behind one of those breaking balls, like the slider or the curveball, if he's going to be like a full-time guy at, you know, say like an SP4 level for a team?
Yeah, I think that's probably the most obvious like development item, so to speak. I do think teams, I won't say this about the Blue Jays in particular, but I think teams are generally resistant to like thinking about these ideas when a guy's rolling, you know? It's like when the guy's really good, you're kind of just like, oh, hands off. Like, I'm just going to let him keep rolling. Like, God forbid we miss something up here. So that's, I think, an approach a lot of teams take. A lot of teams are risk averse in that sense. But I don't necessarily know if that's the proper approach. Like, if he runs through the end of the season and still is doing what he's doing, and you're starting to project him out for next year, like, he's not going to project as like a crazy dominant 3.7 ERA guy. Like, he's probably going to project that around league average just based on his prior history and stuff. But the more he puts up like this, the more you push down those projections. But I'd be more interested in like trying to jump the velocity a little bit, or maybe giving him a different breaking ball and helping versus right-handed hitters in particular, who I think you might have be slightly worse with over time. But he's a really fun pitcher. I mean, he's kind of been one of the pop-up arms of the year, I would say, from the stretch he's gone on. I can't really think of any others that have dominated this much that I think can hold some water heading into next year.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. And like, you know, early on, it was like, okay, well, he's starting to perform well, but the underlying metrics don't like it that much. And they've kept going in the right direction as well. Like, StatCast has him at a 3.60 expected ERA, so almost identical to his ERA. Obviously, just deciding once you came back from AAA, I'm never going to walk a guy ever again, is a really good strategy as well. So I want to use Bowden to pivot toward a video breakdown that you did the other day at Lance Braz on YouTube about deception and how that is the past, present, future of pitching analysis. Like, obviously velocity is good, pitch shape is good, but the thing that we're trying to do when we're talking about pitching is deceive the hitter, get them off balance, trick them. Hey, I thought the ball was going here. And how, like, the interplay of fastball and splitter is the most interesting one to me that we've talked about this year. And that's partially because Kevin Gausman's been here for a while, partially because since Bowden Francis added a splitter, his fastball numbers have gone through the roof. Like his fastball's just been way better playing off the splitter. Obviously, your video on deception goes deeper than we can go here in a 15-minute radio conversation. But, man, what is kind of the high level where we're at right now? And is how pitchers manage deception and how to create it kind of the next frontier now that we know what makes a good pitch and a good pitch shape?
Yeah, I would say that's a reasonable way to summarize it. I think it's inherently difficult because a lot of the things that I talk about in the video, especially when I break it into I break it into two categories, basically tree, body and baseball, you know, the tree, so to speak. So the body side is the one that I don't necessarily know how coachable it is. And perhaps I'm just saying that because on the public side here, we don't have a ton of biomech information around how guys move. So we don't have a lot of those objective variables that teams and organizations have to be able to make more informed decisions about guys. And I think for the most part, it's one of those things on the body side specifically that's more like scoutable. It's like, do you have a good ability to ID what this guy might be doing from a movement perspective that's throwing off hitters? As I put in the video, like, you create an impression that's incorrect. Like, the guy thinks something and then that's not the case. And I think that's really what we're looking at with the body. I broke it down in a couple of ways in terms of like how you get to that. Some of them I really don't think are coachable. I think maybe the only one that's coachable is playing with release height, especially for larger guys, where it's like, you think of like a Yuri Perez or a Paul Skenes, those guys are like 6'6 plus and they have what you'd say are average releases. But anyone who watches them pitch know it's not an average release, right? It's how the body's getting to that release point that I think matters more than we're able to kind of capture. I think there are subtle ways we can do it on the public side. And maybe we could back into a lot of it more than I think, but I haven't seen like a ton of really good research on these elements. So it's one of those things where I almost think it's more of like an explainer than something that I think is very actionable from a training standpoint. The other part that I think is perhaps more actionable from a training standpoint has to do with the baseball, right? These are things like how pitchers interact. You talked about the fastball splitter right there. That's a really good example. That's actually one of the things I asked Bowden Francis about. And I was like, why can't hitters see splitters, given the fact that hitters can see spin, we think, and that pitch is spinning 1,000 RPM lower than any other pitch? And the answer to Yammy is that it holds fastball line longer, which I've seen and heard, but it still doesn't really, no offense to Bowden, but it doesn't really answer my question, right? Like, that's the one, if hitters can see spin, you should be able to ID a splitter out of hand immediately. Maybe that gets to the idea that hitters actually don't see much past release, which again, raises the importance of what's happening in the body prior to release, which is why I think things around deception and things around how the body are moving and the visual you create for a hitter are so important. But back to the baseball side, like, there's a pitch interaction. I also think that's pretty coachable, I would say, for the most part, because we get into location, command, et cetera, and how those pitches move and interact. I think the Rays are really good at taking, like, high slot ride guys and giving them really hard sliders that become somewhat invisible. They did it with Todd Bradley this year. I imagine they're going to do it with, you know, Dylan Lesko is the guy I'm thinking of in their minor leagues and others. But then there's the idea of, like, things that have to do with break-off arm angle. So this is kind of combining the body and the baseball side, where it's like your arm angle has a suggested break that hitters would think is coming. And then if you can deviate from the expectation there, you're running into situations where perhaps that pitch is just more effective because the hitter isn't expecting it. A lot of the times what that occurs is just guys cutting the baseball is what I've realized. Like, I've seen Max Bay. This is really cool visual online that I've seen a couple times, which has like this orb.
Yeah.
And then like if you're in the middle of the orb.
Yeah.
The frisbee is a good way to describe it. Yeah, it's like if you're in the middle of that, your ball is what is expected. And then if you're off it, you're running into some movement that maybe isn't expected from your arm angle, which I think is important. But I don't think this is necessarily something that's captured a lot in stuff models. And I bet if you added it to a stuff model, it wouldn't actually do too much in terms of improving pitch quality or becoming more predictive. So I don't know. It suggests that guys who cut the ball are good, and stuff models don't really agree that guys who cut the ball are good. So we run in a very interesting balance there in terms of perhaps some of these things having competing interests, so to speak.
Max Bay, by the way, for anyone who doesn't know, a former neuroscientist who then worked in the Houston Astros research and development team. So this intersection of neuroscience or psychology in baseball is going to be really fascinating to me because, you know, like I remember, I think it was Mookie Betts talking to David Lorela a couple of years ago, and David Lorela of Fangraphs was like, can you tell me like what you're looking for at the plate? And Mookie's answer was basically, and I'm paraphrasing, but it was basically something like, no, I can't tell you what I'm looking for. Like, we don't have a vocabulary for it. I've just seen tens of thousands of pitches, and the brain chunking process just kind of fills in the gap, and you can't verbalize, well, look, the occlusion of the baseball with how the pitcher was holding it behind his back through to the arm angle and then the pitch movement versus what it would normally be expected. Like, you can't describe that entire chain, but after tens of thousands of pitches, your brain can be like, okay, that's a slider. I don't know why, but I know it's a slider. So it's fascinating to kind of imagine how all this stuff could play out. And the hitter side, even where, like, is there, you know, say let's play out the example where even though you said this is probably more descriptive than prescriptive right now, let's play out a scenario where pitchers figure out how to deceive a little bit better. You know, there's a tipping point at which hitters would have seen it enough that it'll stop being deceptive because it becomes the expectation. But also, like, how do you train that? Like, these crazy spin pitching machines are not going to be able to duplicate funky arm angles and weird arm paths and stuff like that. So it really is interesting. When you talk about it being descriptive, at least at this point, do you think it's a fair hypothesis that, like, okay, here's what the stuff models and the pitch modeling metrics think should happen based on these pitches. Here are the actual outcomes. Now, some of that is, oh, there's randomness, there's feeling, whatever, but there is an unquantified, like, deception element to that, especially, like, I think of guys who consistently outperform, say, their stuff plus or their expected ERA or something like that. Do you think that's a fair hypothesis at this point, like that there is a deception factor that we haven't been able to capture yet that explains some of that variance?
Yeah, I think one of the funny secrets on like the data side is that we don't like ERA and anything that's too descriptive.
Right.
We find we have better predictive stats, et cetera. But it's one of those things, like the more sample you get of ERA, the more relevant it becomes is one way to think of it. Like if you have 700 innings of a sub 3.7 ERA and your FIP says you're a 4.2 pitcher, like I think we start to lean slightly more towards thinking you're like a 3.7-ish ERA guy from a true performance standpoint, unless you've run into some of the most incredible luck that any pitcher's ever had. You know, and there's not a ton of guys like this overall. You know, like I can't even think of any off. Javier Assad from the Cubs, obviously I work for the Cubs network, so that comes to mind. But he's a guy, he's not at 700 innings yet, but and he's actually not been great of late. So perhaps this is not making my point. But yeah, he's a weird pitcher where it's like there's not really anything there that works well. Stuff models don't like it. I don't think he has great command. I guess he has reasonable command. We'll say average command. He's just got a lot of pitches. And like, he's a righty too, so you can't even really run into too much of like what I call almost the analyst style deception, which is like, he's a lefty and we don't really understand what's going on, so we're just going to say it's deception. Which is like, the whole point of that video is to like try to break down what exactly we're talking about there, because we could talk about it in a much more sophisticated way. But yeah, I think that's a fair hypothesis, is like, you're overperforming, perhaps it's deception, but we're not really going to know, you know? And I think, again, that gets to the point of how scoutable it is. It's like, if you're, what I say a lot about stuff models is like, organizations have them, and the better organizations, I think, are very confident when they don't use them, if that makes any sense. Like, they're confident when something is saying one thing and they're like, no, the hitter visual here is more important than what we're tracing on like the raw movement velocity side of things. I think teams like the Dodgers and some other orgs do this really well. And I don't know how they've constructed systems in place that allow them to do that, because I do believe a lot of teams are very model driven. And I do think it's almost paramount to have some kind of model or objective like North Star to look at. It's just the Dodgers have done, I think, an amazing job of like not really caring about that a ton, or mixing in these other things on the execution and game planning and advanced scouting and perhaps deception side of things that really work. And maybe that deception boils down to body based, as I said, or maybe it's more like the interaction between two pitches.
Maybe they also just have like incredibly smart hitters who can stand in there and be like, yeah, this is it. Like, obviously it would be way more efficient to do it with cameras and the hyper frame tracking and stuff like that. But I think of an anecdote of like Jeff Hoffman was about to opt out of his minor league deal to go to Japan last April with the Phillies. And then He was pitching rehab stuff to Bryce Harper. And Bryce Harper was like, no, I don't care that he has a 9 ERA in AAA. Like, this slider is nasty. And now he's one of the best relievers of the last 2 years. We just need Bryce, like hundreds of Bryce Harpers at an organization standing in there telling you what they see. You mentioned lefty deception. This is a hard pivot, but I did want to ask you about someone that you wrote about a couple weeks back in your Substack newsletter. There is a Canadian reliever from Vancouver named Matt Tugboat Wilkinson, and he doesn't have the stuff. He doesn't have the pitch modeling numbers and things like that, but he struck out 48% of batters that he saw at low A this year, and then got the bump to high A and still struck out like 33% with like a sub 2.5 ERA. Is that a good example of sometimes it's just like, man, it's a lefty and he's tough to pick up. Like there's not a lot of underlying saying Matt Wilkinson should strike out 40%+ of guys.
The only thing that stands out for him is the fact that he throws from a really low slot. Like, average release is somewhere around 5'10". He's like just above 5 feet. That's a pretty big difference. And he has a really good extension, or not even really good. I think it's like above average. We won't say it's like elite. You know, I think he's around like just under 7 feet. The elite would be pushing into like the 7'2", 7'3". So that's really it. Like, that's all I have on him. That's the only reason I could see he's getting to a 40% K rate. It doesn't make any sense to me. He's right now in the minor leagues, to me, the ultimate, like, do you believe in stuff models, or do you believe in like none of that mattering when a guy's doing something even like moderately odd, you know? Like, it's there's some other guys that I've run into where it's like, oh, there's also like a crazy release angle here where it's like he's really far out towards the first base side and he's throwing crossfire. Like, that on top of other things I'm more convinced matter. The only thing with him is that he's throwing from a low slot. He has a good extension. Like, the shapes aren't good. He's not throwing hard. Even if he threw hard, I don't think he would grade out well, you know?
And then it's like
weird part of him.
If that's the thing, do you guys figure it out at some point? It's very like Chad Bradford as a character in Moneyball, right? Of like, well, he's a submariner, and at least for a year or two, guys won't pick that up until they've seen it a bunch of times.
Could be that. It's also the Guardians who are really good at pitching development and IDing these things. So that makes me, it's fair. Like, I'm biased towards the context of teams. Like, Angels call up two guys, Caden Dana and Aldegary, and like those guys overall are not particularly crazy from like a raw pitch shape standpoint and such. So it's one of those things for me where it's like, I'm not entirely sure what they're doing in their minor league system. They don't really grade out too well from my perspective in a lot of what they do in the minors. So, I mean, these other guys are just, I struggle with Wilkinson, honestly. He's the ultimate, like, we will understand if this works at the major league level, I think, pretty quick. And he'll be a fantastic, fascinating test case for like not totally just buying in on stuff models if for some reason this works against better hitters, which I just don't necessarily anticipate happening. But so my bet is on the stuff side, if you're asking for my answer. Like, I just don't think it continues. And I'm going to bet against the Guardians being able to figure this guy out as like a starting pitcher who can actually carve up hitters. I think he'll come up maybe he has like a burst of success, and then I bet he just ends up being a five, which would be a success, or he just falls lower than that and ends up being like a reliever. But I struggle with him, man. I'm just going to bet against it. And he's one of the guys I think I wrote in that Substack piece that I'm comfortable being wrong on him, if right. that makes any sense.
Well, yeah, and if you're wrong on someone like him, we're going to learn something in the process, right? Like, it's not you know, it's not like you're going against what all the data says or the descriptors say. It's if you end up wrong, we'll all be a little smarter about pitching for it, because Tugboat figured something out that we can't capture just yet. Okay, so a lot of the discussion we're having here, a lot of the discussion around pitching analysis in general, stuff oriented. So how do your pitches break? How hard do you throw, et cetera? You had a great video, I think last week or the week prior, about some of the stuff that the Driveline Center is doing, focusing on command and how this is, you know, and this doesn't necessarily apply to Tugboat Wilkinson. We can move off of him. I think he does have a pretty low walk rate, but we're not talking like Zach Eflin low walk rate here. When it comes to command and what we're trying to look at there, how do we get back, or how is Driveline and people like you trying to push pitchers back to, hey, this is how you know, we've got the stuff figured out, but once you get on the mound, you know, your pitches are your pitches. How do we command them a little better?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that this is kind of like the lost, I don't want to say lost art, because I don't necessarily know if it was even trained well in the past. I think guys just naturally had it because they probably threw a little softer and stuff. But the main thing here is just coming up with some structure to train it. And I think really the only way to think about it is through like deliberate practice, is having some constraints, changing those constraints, and perhaps changing the environment, and allowing you to just understand where your targeting should be. And that's really it. Like, and Driveline does some really cool things with projecting intended targets onto, say, a strike zone. So if you're throwing like a bullpen, generally that's thrown into like a nine box or something like that. Like, you ever thrown a pen, like one of those, I mean, I had it when I was a kid, right? Like, it's like four pockets, yeah. Excuse me, nine pockets. Even sometimes they have four if you want to split it up, or you can do it on halves, you know, and you're throwing to that instead of a catcher if you don't have a catcher on a given day. What they'll do is put up like a net, and then they'll put like a black piece, like a batting practice strike zone, you know, you see on batting practice turtles and stuff. And then they'll project, literally put a projector that shows an intended target. And they'll measure that intended target relative to where your pitch ends up. So like through the course of a pen and multiple pens, course of a couple of years training there, you have the ability to look back and understand where your natural misses are, like where you're missing when we target in a certain spot. And that can then inform where your targeting should be. So command, it's funny where I think the raw trait of improving command is something that we understand less than like the targeting element. And we understand it so much less that we would just prefer to fix the targeting side. Perhaps because like guys who throw hard are being incentivized, and generally those guys we just don't maybe think can control finite body movements enough to actually be able to command the baseball. Therefore, we're just like, we're going to set you up such that when you do miss, which is inevitable, it will be in favorable spots. That is like one element of the command side. And the other element of the command side is like actually improving that miss distance, which I don't know if I have a great answer as to how to do. And I'm not entirely sure Driveline does, or most organizations do. You know, a lot of the times you'll just end up with like clean mechanics, efficient mechanics. Well, the definition of efficiency is more output. So you're telling the guy to throw harder if you're telling him to be more clean in his mechanics. If you're not saying that, then like, please tell me what clean mechanics that aren't efficient are, because that's a huge thing that I run into a lot of the time, right? It's mechanics based, et cetera. It's like, okay, cool. You're telling me you want the guy to throw harder. Like that's literally the definition of efficiency, you know? So I run into that stuff a lot of the time where I'm not totally convinced that we have the structures in place to figure out how to command the ball better, how to literally shrink your miss distance, right? We're not talking about like setting up in certain spots to be a better pitcher and miss in certain spots. It's purely just like, you know, I don't want to miss my target as much. I think it might literally just be like a mental thing that we run into like a survivorship bias of where like the guys who are 32 plus have figured out how to command the baseball, however that is. Maybe it's just mental maturation and understanding like there's some element beyond the age of like 27 where you start to click, and then there's outliers of like the George Kirby and Zevi Matthews and others who like can command the ball prior. And it's like, I don't really know what that is. And again, it gets back to what we're talking about in Inception. Like maybe it's just scoutable, not too coachable. And that opens a really interesting wrinkle into like what teams are valuing on the pitching side. So that's where I end up with command. I don't necessarily think we have answers for it, but I obviously think it's important. And it's not just that models can't really figure out what command is, or, you know, walk rate and other things maybe aren't too predictive. it's there, it's relevant. We need to figure out how to actually like attack it from a training standpoint. I'm not on the front lines of that. I'm more like the person that's just curious about how other people are doing it. If you're on the front lines of it, that is fascinating, because I imagine this is a very difficult topic where the answer is probably just throw harder.
And like, what are you going to do like once you get into game situations? Like you want your catcher setting up a target, but you don't want them like setting up too discreet a target and giving something away. Like it's not like we can really measure miss distance by where a catcher set up, because they're not going to, you know, just in case, they're not going to give away an exact target location and things like that. And then you get into, okay, well, is good command, well, one part of good command is, you know, missing by less. And then a part of that is also probably knowing to which direction you miss, where if you are, you know, let's say, I haven't dug in on his heat maps, but let's say Zebby Matthews, who doesn't walk anyone yet, is getting hit hard because his version of command is, well, I'm going to miss, and if I miss, it's for a strike rather than wasting balls. It's like, okay, well, then you might be missing into the heart of the plate. Whereas if you're a guy who can miss just off low and away, that's such a safer spot to miss. And then you trust your command to, hey, if I miss for a ball a couple times, I can still get it back in the zone and not walk too many guys. It's a fascinating, holistic thing, how we measure command. Lance, I've taken up enough of your time, man. Keep up all the great work. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Blake. Take care, man.
Lance Brozdowski. It's at Lance Broz on YouTube, on Twitter, on Substack. A wealth of good stuff. Can't recommend the video on command and the other video we discussed about deception. Can't recommend those enough. They're about 10 to 12 minute watches each. So yeah, after this show's done, go check those out. Really, really smart stuff. And not only really smart stuff, but really smart stuff that's coming from, hey, what are teams trying to do at the minor league level? What are teams trying to do at the major league level? What are the places that these guys are going in the off season to work on stuff? What are they trying to do with pitchers? You know, Driveline's the example that gets used in the command story. But just in general, there are a handful of these places that, you know, a Bowden Francis is going to. A Cole Ragans was the big one last year. In the middle of the season, he gets traded from the Texas Rangers, takes a stint over at Driveline, it comes back with more velocity, and suddenly he's really, really good for the Kansas City Royals. So a lot of fascinating stuff, and Lance is super, super smart. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll stick with smart guys. We'll talk to Craig Goldstein of Baseball Prospectus. We'll talk to Bobby Wagner about the Mets, who are in town this week for a 3-set. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
The best Blue Jays show out there, period. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jay's Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. That's Illuminati Hotties, a little song called Falling in Love with Somebody Better, which is a good theme for, hey, almost time to pick a team you'll be rooting for in the playoffs, since the Toronto Blue Jays won't be there. Obviously, we have talked about our Dodgers a lot on this show. Jays fans probably not as fond of the Dodgers as maybe in years past, but they're always a fun team to check in on. They won 2 of 3 against the Cleveland Guardians on the weekend. Let's see how they're doing. Let's talk to our pal Craig Goldstein, editor-in-chief at Baseball Prospectus and one of the hosts of the Five and Dot podcast. Craig, what's up, man? How are we doing?
We're doing okay. We're surviving, I suppose, is one way to talk about it.
It is, yeah. I mean, you're a I know, look, you're an everything guy at Baseball Prospectus. You're also a Dodgers guy. Yeah. Pretty firmly in, like, let's just get to the playoffs mode now. Like, 2 of 3 against Cleveland, had taken 3 out of 4 against the Diamondbacks to more or less put the NL West to bed. They've got a 4-game cushion to secure a bye through the first round, at least. We just didn't, like, get us to the playoffs in bubble wrap mode now?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, it's a little bit more like we need to unwrap some of these guys to make sure that they can function when we do get there, right? They're going to have Yoshinobu Yamamoto coming off the IL on Tuesday in a fun matchup against the Cubs and Shota Imanaga. We're going to see if Tyler Glasnow can race back to get healthy. We don't know the status of Clayton Kershaw. I mean, they've got what I think they said Gavin Stone just went on the IL, and he probably won't make it back. I think he was the 12th starter that they've had, not counting openers, to land on the IL this year. So I think both they want to bubble wrap I want to say the guys that are healthy, but it's really just Jack Flaherty at this point. Mm-hmm. A rotation is more of a conceptual thing here. than actually something that they have in reality. But yeah, I think at this point, the leads that you mentioned are real. It's only 19 games left for the till the end of the season for them, which feels very quick, but I guess we are in early September. But yeah, so they just have to survive that, but they also have to get healthy in that time.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And 19 games left, they'll probably use like 13 different starters the way things have gone. At least Jack Flaherty's been really good. Like 2.61 ERA since it's coming over. Seven shutout on the weekend, I think. He's been really good. Where is the expectation on a Yamamoto or Glasnow in terms of, yeah, Yamamoto will be back tomorrow and obviously was quite good before he went down. But... you know, is he going to give you six innings if Glasnow comes back? He was already, I believe, pushing or had already eclipsed, you know, the most innings he'd thrown in a few years here. Like, are we headed for, even if they get healthy, it's a lot of like twice through the order and done in the playoffs for this Dodgers rotation other than Flaherty?
Yeah, I think for Yamamoto, that's the big question, because he's always been a high innings count guy in Japan, right? I mean, one of the reasons they went so hard for him in the offseason was he had the track record of staying healthy. We talk a lot about the Dodgers' injuries. There have been two big and notable pieces, one by Fabian Ardaia at The Athletic and one just this morning from Jack Harris at the LA Times, talking about the Dodgers' injuries. And Andrew Friedman was heavily quoted about needing to look internally this offseason about what they're going to do. But Yamamoto stands separate from their recent acquisition strategy, which is to target some of these high upside but high injury prone guys. And we saw it with Andrew Heaney a few years ago, Tyler Glasnow, different level of upside, but also a substantial injury history. But Yamamoto was supposed to be different, right? He was supposed to have this training regimen that allowed him to be healthy. They brought his trainer in, they adopted some of his practices, things like that. So all that to say, I don't know. I think the normal course of action would lead me to say, yeah, probably more of a five and dive, not trying to reference the podcast, but type situation, maybe 18 to 21 batters faced. We'll see what he can do. But he's also kind of just a different guy. And so I don't know if that's necessarily the plan for him. We'll just have to see how he looks. I would also know it took him a little bit to find his splitter, as the season rolled on, and he had really hit his stride on that front, before the injury. We'll see how long it takes him to do that. I think that's going to matter for pitch counts and for how long he can go into a game.
This is not related to the conversation necessarily, but to let you know where my brain is at as a baseball person is I had a note in my notes to ask you about Walker Buehler, but I spelt it Burley because obviously I'm just so deeply fond of Mark Burley still. I mean, Buehler, I think probably
we miss him. We miss the style of pitching, everything about him.
The final game of the season a few years back where the Jays tried to get him to the 200 inning mark and he landed on 199.2 because the defense failed behind him. It was heartbreaking. I guess it wasn't a few years ago now. It was almost a decade ago now because
few years ago to us,
Bob. The inexorable march of time. Yeah. So Walker Buehler, I'm sure, falls into the Glasnow Yamamoto, you know, let's see what we can get out of him territory. They have obviously, because of all these injuries, even more recently had to call more guys up because, you know, River Ryan wasn't effective or Gavin Stone hits the IL. Clayton Kershaw goes back on the IL. Bobby Miller still yikes, but Landon Knack looked okay this time. Like, could either of those guys factor in the playoffs? Like obviously anyone can factor in as a long man, but Knack or Miller, if they're starting a playoff game, that's a pretty yellow flag. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and for different reasons, we'll see what they look like, I guess, over the next 19 games here. But to touch on Buehler, he's actually looked a little bit better these last couple starts. They've dropped his pitch mix down. He's basically just throwing three pitches, and it's paying off a little bit. It's not Walker Buehler revolt. It's a different guy, but it's someone who at least was going five plus innings and you know, two earned runs, something like that, something they could work with, essentially. Bobby Miller, I mean, two starts ago looked incredible. Two or three starts ago, he had nine strikeouts, still giving up a lot of hits, but nine strikeouts, no walks, something like that. Then you think, oh, maybe he'll get kind of a soft landing against the Angels. Maybe he can get on a roll here, except he gave up five runs in the first inning. Also struck out eight, by the way, had just an unbelievably nasty changeup. But it's a little bit of the, I think Jays fans would resonate with it, a little bit of the when Kevin Gausman is bad, he's not actually always bad, but he gets hit really hard. Mm-hmm. While the stuff can still be nasty and miss bats and get strikeouts, it's the same thing. When Bobby Miller throws a fastball, it's getting absolutely hammered. When he was throwing the changeup, I think, again, he had 8 strikeouts, 7 on the changeup. So there's something to work with there. It's just, what are they going to get out of him? And Knack also 8 strikeouts in his last outing, as you point out, but just a lower ceiling guy in general. They've tended to use an opener in front of him in a number of starts, I guess, to get him a little bit deeper into the game. They're more comfortable when his third time through the order starts off with that, the kind of the bottom of the order rather than the top. And I think that's probably what they would do in the playoffs. We saw them do it a number of times in their run to the title in 2020, where they used Tony Gonsolin and Walker Buehler just to start a game, maybe an inning or two, and then turned it over to somebody else. So I think they're just going to have to survive again and see what those guys can offer. Absolutely a yellow flag, but they don't really have any other options.
Yeah, it's the only color flag they got. Exactly. What are you going to do? And I mean, look, the opener stuff, the getting funky with times through the order, like when you have 7 to 8 reasonably solid guys in the bullpen, which they do have, at least by, you know, the results. Like Anthony, they turned Anthony Bonda into a guy who can pitch and leverage sometimes yesterday aside. I trust them. I'm not a big fan of the opener in general or the trend that we've had in playoff pitching, but if I'm going to trust someone to execute it, it's probably a team. The Dodgers and the Rays are the two teams that I'll be like, okay, I see. The Jays try it, I'm like, no, thank you. Okay, so on the position player side for the Dodgers, there are far fewer question marks. The one question mark that we were dealing with for a good chunk of the season was, when would Max Muncy get back and what would he look like? 173 weighted runs created plus since he came back. Sorry, I don't have DRC plus in front of me. I know I should always look that one up instead. How has that been? Is that concern like firmly back pocket now for this Dodgers team?
Yeah, I mean, the question for me was, how's he going to look playing defense? Because he had actually started to play a little bit better defense. I think there's a running a bit, apparently, between him and Dave Roberts. Max Muncy says he can dunk a basketball, and Dave Roberts didn't believe him. But he got up there to get a ball at a crucial double play against the Guardians this weekend. So the bat is always a little streaky, right? He walks so much, he takes so many pitches that sometimes he's just going to go into those ruts. He had 2 big home runs in his return off the IL. He had another one yesterday off a lefty, you know, left less. It was Anthony Gose, who's been DFA'd, I think, 4 times in the last month or so. But, you know, anything off a lefty counts. And, yeah, I think he's just been a steadying presence. They have been platooning him and Gavin Lux pretty hard. They'll sub a guy out, or they'll start Kike Hernandez at third base or something like that. But yeah, it's been a big solidifying force in their lineup, just because I actually don't even mind him against lefties because of how patient he is, because he can draw a walk and make pitchers work. And I think he just, again, you're hitting him anywhere from 5th through 7th. And if you're in that situation, you're pushing Will Smith down to 6th sometime. The lineup just has a lot of depth at this point.
Yeah. Anthony Gose, by the way, who has over 20 transaction items on his transaction log on MLB.com since August 6th.
It's not a fun life. I'm glad he's in the majors at times, but that does not sound fun.
No, it doesn't. Okay, then there's the obvious Dodgers question when we're talking about Dodgers position players. Shohei has 46 and 46. Mm. We're heading toward the first ever 50-50 season. I guess the easy question is, does he get there?
Yes.
Okay. When does he get there? Because Ben Clemens at Fangraphs projected it today and was like, okay, I remember everyone was doing this during Aaron Judge's chase of like, which day would he get it? And I instead of sitting in media seats, I sat in left field seats for every one of the Jays Aaron Judge games. And I was in there for the tire, but not the breaker. When does he do it? Like, how soon are we talking here?
Look, I'm no expert. I'm not Ben Clemens on a projection thing here. So I defer to him. I don't know where he landed, but I'm gonna say Saturday the 21st.
Okay, against the Rockies, do it at home. That is a Shohei Ohtani T-shirt giveaway day as well.
Why not? Oh my God, that's perfect. How could you not? I think he's just gonna have to wait. Maybe he'll get there on home runs before, wait for the stolen base. Those are much more in his control, and he's been very aggressive about them recently.
Yeah, let me tell you, I don't know who's gonna be starting for the Rockies that day, but it won't be anyone good, that's for sure. Elsewhere in the National League, so part of the Dodgers establishing, hey, the NL West is ours, we don't have to worry about it. We don't have to worry about the bye, has been that they took three or four against the Diamondbacks, and the Diamondbacks have just really cooled off in general. Three key, I know Ketel Marte came back off the IL, but a couple key guys on the injured list there, including our old friends Gabriel Moreno and Lourdes Gurriel Jr., not the best pitching staff at best of times. How do we, like, are we firmly at a point now where we need to reframe the NL wildcard race as, hey, it's four teams fighting for three spots, whereas a week ago it looked like, hey, the Mets are chasing the Braves? Like, do you think that's fair, and do the Pecota projections bear that out?
Yeah, I do think that's fair. They don't quite bear it out. They have the Mets a bit further behind than everyone else. And I don't know that that's exactly reasonable, or that's where I land, right? Obviously, the Mets have been very hot. At the same time, the Diamondbacks, Christian Walker is back. You mentioned Ketel Marte. Walker missed a bunch of time with a strained oblique. Does not look the same since he has. So even though some of these guys are back, they're not exactly themselves, and I think that's playing a big role. They are the league's best offense, but they haven't been playing like it. Again, you mentioned the number of injuries. Gabby Moreno, certainly a big part of that, but Adrian Del Castillo had come out of nowhere to be an offensive sensation. But one of the big things you've seen with that, and I saw this a lot in the Dodgers series, is they'll really run on him, whereas Gabby Moreno, obviously a huge defensive presence in terms of preventing running.
So he has, this being Del Castillo, has started 17 games at catcher. Base runners are 25 for 26 stealing bases.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not crazy. And the thing is, Gabby Moreno is preventative, right? You're just not even going to get, it's not even about the guys he catches, which he will, but it's that guys just will not run because of how strong his arm is. And it's a big difference maker, especially in close games. And we saw how the Diamondbacks used that to their advantage last playoffs. And it's being used against them a little bit down the stretch here. I do think it is more of an open situation at this point. They're not far back from, the Mets and really Atlanta are not far back from the Diamondbacks at this point. Maybe I feel a little bit more confident in what the Padres bring to the table, that they're more secure in having a playoff spot in general. Where they'll be, I don't know as much. I don't know that most of these teams care that much which wild card spot they're in, as long as they're in one of them.
Yeah, and I think that's the best way to do it, especially now that, like, you know, it's not locked, but for a little while there, it looked like Milwaukee could catch the Dodgers or the Phillies for one of the buys.
Absolutely.
But now, you know, Milwaukee's going to be one of the teams. What do you make of Milwaukee? Because they're a team that, you know, whether you look at betting odds, Pecota's projections, whatever, they have had a playoff spot locked up forever. And until this past week, looked like they were in the mix for a buy at least. But none of the projection systems, or even just like looking around baseball media or the betting odds or anything like that, nobody really sees the Brewers as a threat to make a deep run. I think you guys have them at 4% World Series odds, which, given they've had the division locked up forever, feels a little light. What do you make of that?
Yeah, we are at 4%. I think some of it is that the Central is generally a weak division. We've had Matthew Trueblood writing about both Centrals, the AL and NL, in a series called Flyover Country all year, because he pitched us preseason, and he's right that they're very interesting in how they tend to be a weaker division and how that kind of ecosystem operates. But the Brewers, along with the A's, I think were one of two teams that hit their over mark in terms of our projections, and I think Vegas projections in August. I mean, they were so far better, so much better than we anticipated, than the betting odds anticipated preseason. I think they're remarkable. I mean, that's what I think of Milwaukee in general. Their offense, and again, they brought up Jackson Churio after they gave him a contract, and he struggled for 2 months. And, you know, I was kind of raising an eyebrow saying, couldn't he have done some of this at AAA? Did we have to see this? And since, I think, the beginning of June, he's been one of the best hitters in baseball. They lost Christian Yelich, but they gained Jackson Churio. And there hasn't been much of a difference between those two guys. Now, they could use both of them, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying everything's okay, but their offense really didn't skip a beat. And I've been really impressed with how they've built that offense, because they've been, if you had an identity for this team heading up to this year, it would be their pitching development, right? It would be kind of an average-ish offense and surviving on their pitching when it was Burns, Woodruff, and Peralta. Obviously, Burns is in Baltimore. Woodruff is on the IL. And Peralta hasn't been as good as he has been last year. He's still very good, but not as good as he has been. And so it's really been the offense. Christian Yelich looked like Christian Yelich of old. Bryce Turing started out hot. I know he's faded a little bit, but Willy Adames has come back. Wilson, William Contreras, has been one of the best best hitting catchers in baseball. Once again, the Rhys Hoskins signing is playing out really well, I think, or at least as they thought it would. So I think they've done a really good job just rebuilding their identity as a team. And then, again, transitioning from Craig Counsell to Pat Murphy without missing a beat. And the bullpen continues. They continue to develop guys that you might not have heard of, guys like Brian Hudson, and surviving with this pitching staff. It's been a really incredible job from their front office, from their management, and from the players themselves.
Yeah, arguably the best base running team in baseball as well when you look at little ways to gain advantages. And not just stolen base, the overall base running metrics. So they're a fascinating team. Yeah, I don't know. You look at the starting rotation and I get why no one's like, yeah, that's the team that'll go on a run. But I don't know. You think playoff baseball and being able to run like that and having a good bullpen is a pretty good starting point. So it'd be interesting to see how that side plays out. So that is the National League. Let's take a look quickly on the American League side here. Yankees, Orioles, neither team wants to win the division here. Neither team wants to get the bye. Nobody seems to want to win the AL Central either. Like, those teams just keep jockeying with losing streaks. What's going on here, man?
Yeah, a tremendous lack of want. I mean, look, I think on the Baltimore front, they're dealing with injuries just like a lot of these other teams we're talking about, right? Their rotation especially. Look, I think they would be in a position where they'd much rather not be pitching Chase McDermott and Cade Povich. And look, I think they like both of these guys. I don't think they want to pitch them in September of a pennant race. You know what I'm saying? Grayson Rodriguez, they're really missing. They got Zach Eflin back relatively recently. He's been a little bit up and down really all season, but since he came back, I think they just, Corbin Burnes is hitting a stretch of starts where he just has not been very good. I think maybe there's a little bit of running out of gas, which again, not as a team, but some of these individual guys. And again, that happens across the league. They're not the only ones dealing with this. Because again, you see the Yankees are dealing with it as well. It's the Aaron Judge and Juan Soto show. And Aaron Judge just, I know it's only been 9 days into September now, but he hasn't homered all month, right? So which is not something you normally hold against somebody, but when it's Aaron Judge, it's like, wait, is something off here? Is everything okay? Half a game separating these two teams. They're going to play, I believe, this month, but it's they're both kind of stumbling towards the finish heading into it in a strong way. I think for the Yankees, the way that they get back to it is they get Clark Schmidt back. They got Luis Gil back. Both looked pretty good coming off the IL. That's going to mean a lot for their pitching. I know Nestor Cortes wasn't thrilled about being taken out of the rotation, but he gave it his all. He looked really good for four innings, backing up Clark Schmidt. They're going to suddenly be a lot deeper in the rotation than they have been the last stretch or so.
And I mean, moving a rotation guy to the bullpen helps what's been a not bad bullpen overall, but a questionable bullpen of like whose day is it today? Which Mark Leiter showed up? Which Clay Holmes is showing up? Kind of thing.
I know it's not, he's only dealing with things that have happened on the field, but it feels like, honestly, the biggest problem in New York is Aaron Boone press conferences. I appreciate his honesty, but sometimes I'm just like, lie to me a little bit, big guy. It's okay. Like, just don't be honest about it. And you'll have a much better time. I'll have a much better time. We're all just going to agree. We're in on this lie together, and we're getting through the end of the season here.
Do what Brian Cashman is doing and lie. Tell us that Jason Dominguez is not as good as Alex Verdugo. Just lie. It's allowed. Baltimore and New York play the final week of the season, a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday series. So division could very much come down to that. Okay, before I let you go here, we probably only have time for one more. One of your coworkers at Baseball Perspective, natural phenom Steve, who does the Stuff Pro and Pitch Pro stuff, seems like a lot of cool stuff is coming when it comes to deception and tunneling. What are you curious to know? Like, I don't know about you. I can't speak that stuff at the language of Steve or Lance Brzdowski, who was just on with us, or Max Bay. Yeah. But what are you hoping to learn as that stuff develops? Like, hey, we've got the quality of pitching. We've got the location. Now there's this deception factor that maybe helps us explain some of the gap between stuff and results.
Yeah, we've been working on tunneling for a long time at Baseball Perspectives. We have a kind of a landmark article from Harry Pavlidis and Jeff Long and a few other folks, I don't know, probably 8 years ago now, something around there. And I think what Steve and Max and a bunch of other people who are looking into this are doing is really advancing upon that in an interesting way. But it's tracking the decision time, and we have better stats, I should point out, from Hawkeye and the, you know, how many frames it captures and stuff like that compared to what we were dealing with at the time. I think the advancements on that and seeing like how quickly these guys have to make decisions, where batters are at a decision point from and how much the pitch diverges from that, I think we're just going to see a lot of really interesting stuff out of that. And possibly the most interesting stuff, and I should point out this was covered in a really great presentation from some guys line at Sabre Seminar, which was earlier this month, where I got to meet Steve and briefly Lance. It's a great program, is that... Is how these things interact with each other in terms of arsenal scores or however you want to call it. I know, you know, Saris has been looking into those for a very long time as well. But how pitches interact with each other, how, you know, people talk about the cutter as a bridge pitch in terms of its movement to confuse batters or make them hesitate on what pitch is coming, things like that. I think we're going to see which pitches complement each other the most, which ones set the other ones up for success, and how those can build into a better understanding of what a pitcher is maybe missing, what a pitcher is using too much of, and again, how can we increase the quality of certain pitches? And we have a general understanding. I think a lot of it is reinforcing what pitching coaches and pitchers have been talking about for very long times in terms of movement, in terms of setting guys up, but we have a way we can do a little bit more quantification of that. And I think that's really cool. I honestly, like, yes, it's absolutely great to disrupt something or to come up with an idea that's absolutely revolutionary. I think it's really valuable to be able to put some numbers behind longstanding ethoses or practices within the game. And I think that's some of what we can do with this kind of stuff.
Yeah, and just help explain why, right? Like, okay, we know that a splitter and a fastball play off each other, and that's probably why Bowden Francis's fastball has played better since he added the splitter. But why? Why is Brian Bayo's slider suddenly getting a huge ground ball rate now that he's playing it off a sinker instead of the four-seamer that he was throwing before? I mean, the Red Sox are just like, unless you're Nick Pivetta, you don't get to throw a four-seamer at all anymore, because beyond, you know, underneath a certain level of stuff, the sinker and cutter maybe help the rest of your arsenal more than a four-seamer does. Like, questions like that, and we can help, you know, start to figure out why, in addition to, hey, that's a, you know, that slider broke from here to there, or, oh, Paul Skeens has a changeup now and it's unfair. We can get into some of the why more at the marginal stuff, yeah, with a lot of guys.
Just real quick, another big example is Hunter Brown. We had an article on him earlier this season, obviously turned things around by throwing a sinker. But if you look at the grades on the sinker, it's not that good. But the presence of it is crucial, where he's able to throw it, what it means for batters in terms of game planning or identifying specific pitches is a really big deal. And I think it's one of the reasons why you look at guys who were sinker slider guys. Just, you go back to Justin Masterson of old, two pitches, but can be really successful because they're coming in the same slot and they're veering off in completely different directions. I think we've covered that for a while, but we're going to be able to do more stuff like that and get into why other pitches have been able to work kind of in similar ways.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And yeah, to your point about, hey, what does this pitcher need? We'll be able to, hey, go work on this in the offseason, and we can armchair pitching coach it even better than we already do. Craig, thanks so much for taking the time out, buddy. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Craig Goldstein, editor-in-chief at Baseball Prospectus and the Five and Dive podcast. A ton of great work going on over there, and yeah, it's Steve who works on, you know, some of their Pitch Pro and Stuff Pro metrics there. And the one thing I love about like baseball analytics community is that like it seems like, even though there's people from Fangraphs and Baseball Prospectus and on the team side and Driveline, really does seem like everyone's just like working together to figure this stuff out. The Jays going to try to work together with the New York Mets to get the New York Mets into the playoffs these three games. By the way, two small updates. One, the Mets have announced that Paul Blackburn's not starting tonight. He was supposed to come off the IL and make the start. Tyler McGill is going to start again. We'll break that one down in the final segment. Also, a congratulations to Chris Bassett. He has been named the Jays 2024 Roberto Clemente Award nominee for character, community involvement, positive contributions off the field as well. So congrats to Chris Bassett and the Bassett family, who do a ton of great work in the community here and, you know, paying forward you know, what he's able to do on the field and what baseball has afforded him. It's great. And the Blue Jays as an organization do a great job of that. Speaking of which, tomorrow is the Sports That Jays Care broadcast auction. Head to BlueJays.com/auction to bid on incredible packages from the chance to golf with Jose Bautista, a trip to New York City with Dan Schulman, a trip to Panama to fish with Buck Martinez. Once again, that's BlueJays.com/auction. How mad is Dan Schulman going to be when it's me that wins that trip to New York City with him? Let's take a break. Let's go down to New York City. We'll talk to Bobby Wagner of Tip and Pitches about the Mets next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Your daily dose of everything NFL. It's the Fan Checkdown with Matt Marchese and Donovan Bennett. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, little Jeff Rosenstock playing us back as we're joined by Bobby Wagner of Tip and Pitches of The Ringer. Got to meet Bobby down in New York when I saw Jeff Rosenstock and Pup the other week. Bobby, how we doing, man?
I'm doing good, man. Not as good as I was when I saw you on the floor at Jeff Rosenstock and Pup, but, you know, we can't always recreate that on a Monday morning. But here we are. Happy to talk to you.
Certainly not on radio or on Zoom. I don't have the energy to do it. Well, I guess I am doing a two-hour show, but not at the energy level of Jeff Rosenstock and the rest of those guys. Man, Mets side, how you feeling? The nine-game winning streak is over. But pretty good stretch of ball for the Mets. They're alive.
Is it a pulling the curtain back a little bit too much to say I'm like a little bit relieved that the nine-game winning streak is over? Mostly because I was like, how long can this go? How much pressure can we add on top of this? When is this going to come crashing down? It feels good to still win the series. I know it doesn't feel great to lose in game three of the series against the Reds, but, you know, two out of three ain't bad. And I feel really good. I mean, this team is legitimately good. They're not great. They're not going to blow any teams away. They're not the favorite, but they're fun and they're good. And it's September, and that's all I could ever ask for.
So you are dealing with a weird feeling of wanting that win streak to end, just so that's a little pressure off. Is it a weird feeling that, like, maybe it's an insular pocket of baseball Twitter, I'm not sure, but it's felt for so long that, like, people laughed at the Mets and now everyone is laughing with them, and like they're kind of, I called them last week like the idiot's favorite to make, like I'm putting my rooting interest behind the Mets to get one of these wild card spots and I'm an idiot. So is that a little weird that everyone's laughing with you instead of at you as the Mets right now?
It's a little weird. I mean, it does feel, far be it for me to say it feels like 2015, because the Mets caught an incredible wave and the division was a lot weaker, and then and they were able to ride that into the playoffs, and the starting rotation really carried them. But in that way that the Yoenis Cespedes trade felt, where it felt like, oh, everybody has now turned their attention to the Mets, something fun is going on here, there's a streak, it can never be just normal, we're playing solid 600 ball, it has to be we're ripping off 10 straight after being one of the worst teams in baseball for this first month, of course. But I relate to what you're talking about, but I do feel a little bit of worry that the spotlight is a little bit too hot on us right now. So I'm like, can you guys just let us crawl under the rock and be weird for a couple more weeks before the playoffs roll around? And then hopefully we can let our freak flag fly in October.
You mentioned the 2015 playoffs there. Unfortunately, the season got called after game five of the ALCS that year. Didn't finish out. There was no World Series champion crowned, nothing like that. In seriousness, so the Jays took only one of three against the Braves on the weekend. Didn't do you guys a huge favor there. But elsewhere in the National League, the Diamondbacks have really kind of fallen to earth lately as well. How much has it, if at all, changed your kind of confidence in the Mets pulling this off, that they're now not just chasing one team? It's ostensibly four teams fighting for three spots the rest of the way here rather than two for one.
It has raised my confidence a lot, honestly. It did not feel good when it was just chasing the Atlanta Braves, because that team is built on such a solid foundation, and it's maybe not the foundation that we were expecting this year. You know, the Braves are leading the league in pitching war, Fangraphs pitching war, which I would not have predicted heading into this season. I would not have predicted a Chris Sale National League Cy Young Award, which seems like it's well on its way. But they've been able to get great stuff out of all those guys in that rotation, and it's been the lineup that's really held them back. But then again, the Mets just have so much history with the Braves kind of dunking all over them at the end of the season, not just last year, not just 2 years ago, rather, but dating back to my entire baseball watching life of the entire century so far. And so it didn't feel good when that was the one team that you were chasing. It feels a lot better when you have three teams, and if any one of them sort of hits a cold streak, that could get you into the playoffs. I don't know which of those teams it's going to be, because it feels like all three of those teams have really risen to the call of the Mets being hot on their tail. You know, it's, and that's exciting, honestly, if I can put my Mets fandom aside for a second. It's exciting that we have a good wild card race, because you look around the rest of the league and it's kind of a bummer. You know, it's kind of a race to the bottom for a lot of these division races. And there's a couple hot ones in there. You know, the AL East, they're stumbling their way into whatever a division race looks like over there. But other than that, I mean, it's just been exciting to watch, to scoreboard watch around the league and be like, this matters.
What a year to have fallen flat on your face in the American League East when you know, there was so much opportunity there in the wild card race and even the division race. Great. Love it. Love it. Awesome stuff. Okay. So the Mets, in addition to having multiple teams that they can chase now and knock off, the other thing that maybe, and this is more of a basketball brain thing, but it's helpful to have the best player in any series, right? And the Mets obviously have that in Mark Vientos. forget Francisco Lindor for a second. How fun has that been? Like, obviously, like, projected as a reasonably useful guy, but 24 home runs and, like, by far the best overall numbers on the team, basically locked in the three spot in the order every day. Man, that's got to have been a big part of this and a lot of fun for you guys.
It's so fun. And we, you know, we watch 162 baseball games a year, and what we're hoping for is pleasant surprises. And Mark Vientos, to say he's a pleasant surprise would be a gross understatement. I mean, it's one of the most remarkable player development turnarounds that I can remember in my time as a Mets fan. But even just looking around the league, this is a guy who clearly had pop. He clearly has the bat speed. He clearly has the overall general macro sense athleticism. He looks the part, right? But you looked at actually the quality of his contact last year, and it was a lot of weak contact, and there were a lot of easy ways to pitch him and get him out. Up and in, he just could not get the bat head to the ball last year, and he was not making fly ball hard contact. He was just drilling everything into the ground, and it just reminds me how much of baseball is a mystery. You know, some of the smartest people in the industry looking at this and being like, how do we turn this around? And it's just a player making a small adjustment, being able to get the ball in the air in unprecedented ways for any of the other Mets hitters who are having problems with the same thing. We put our eggs in the basket of Brett Beatty at the beginning of the year, and he's still having the same problems that Vientos was having last year. And so it's not like you can point to the Mets development system and say, hey, they can fix anybody. They can turn anyone into Jose Bautista. But Mark Vientos just figured out a way to take some of those lessons and apply them. And man, it's just meant so much. He's just been so, so big for the team this year.
It's huge. 24 homers, I think 20 doubles as well. And like I said, fixture in the middle of that order. In seriousness, obviously, Francisco Lindor has been the best Met overall in the MVP conversation there. Is this from a position player only side? Like, do you have to go back to, like, Beltran, Wright, 06, 07, 08 for the last time a Met had a season this good?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, overall quality, as well as being kind of the front and center leader of the team, you do have to go back that far. I do think people forget how good Beltran, Wright, and also Carlos Delgado was from the plate, at least, to not providing quite as much defensive value. I know that that hits home for you guys up there. But he is incredible. And he has always been reliable and always so committed to being a professional baseball player and being out there every day and providing a level of solid foundation of always being a good defender, always trying really hard, always hustling. But what we're seeing now is we're seeing a 90th percentile Francisco Lindor season, which Mets fans unfortunately haven't had yet so far. Because guess what? Most players don't get to their 90th percentile outcome every year or even every 3 years. So you just have to appreciate it when everything kind of clicks and it comes together over a summer. Because like I said with Mark Vientos, so much of it is a mystery. And Francisco Lindor has just been able to put it together this year for whatever reason that is, whether he's feeling healthy, he's feeling good. You know, he's dealt with a little some nicks over the years, like some thumb injuries, some hand injuries, that sort of thing since he's been on the Mets. But man, what a player. What a player he is to watch every day and appreciate. I wrote something for The Ringer when he was first traded to the Mets and then signed that extension, that it didn't feel like we had had a foundation that would last that long that could then attract people to want to come to the Mets to commit over the course of 10 or 11 years or whatever his extension was. And he has lived up to that and more, you know, and you don't necessarily see it when you watch just one game, but when you were fortunate enough to watch him 140 games a year, it's so comforting. It's like a weighted blanket. Like, I sleep well every night knowing that Lindor is going to be manning shortstop tomorrow.
Yeah, like Yeah, probably going to win it. I mean, it's a tough Gold Glove category with Terang and Swanson in there, but he's probably going to win a Gold Glove and finish second in MVP voting. It's pretty...
Hey now, wait, we're not giving up on first yet.
I mean, okay, so this was going to be a sillier question for after, but I saw tweets to the effect of, like, there is an LA media bias, and that's why Shohei is ahead of Francisco Lindor in the MVP voting. And I've also, obviously, Yankees fans are always complaining about an anti-New York media bias. Have New York baseball fans lost their damn minds? Like, an anti-Yankees media bias? What are we talking about here?
The answer to have New York baseball fans lost their damn minds is always yes. You can just always chalk that one up to be a yes. There's not an anti-New York media bias. I do think that there is a rightful pro-Shohei Ohtani media sentiment. I wouldn't even call it a bias. Like, he is amazing. What he does is unprecedented. He is more than deserving of an MVP. But then again, you know, you look at Lindor's numbers, you look at the total value. And I do think that we may be pointing to quote-unquote unprecedented counting stats for Ohtani and saying that cinches him the MVP because of precedent. But, you know, not everybody who went 40-40 won the MVP. I think that just because we most recently saw it with Ronald Acuna Jr. unanimously winning the MVP for going 40-70 or whatever it was, 40-72 or something like that, which was unbelievable. I think that makes people think that Ohtani will just kind of run away with it. I don't know. I'm not totally convinced. I think that baseball... voters every once in a while show a propensity to take things in totality a little bit more than you expect. I do think, you know, based on the betting markets, which I'm not a huge sports bettor myself, but based on the betting markets, it seems like it's kind of wrapped up.
Yeah, it's and who knows, like the people who vote on these things are not allowed to bet, so they wouldn't be swinging the lines. But generally, like, historically speaking, whether you bet or not, those lines do tend to project fairly well the way these things are going to go. Okay, so the Mets, I mean, they're looking pretty good on that side. Top five to top eight offense overall. The pitching staff's been a little dicier, where they've gotten a lot of innings from the starters, but not at a particularly, you know, high level. Now we're heading into a series where we thought Paul Blackburn was going to start today. He's out. Tyler McGill's in. So bullpen-ish day. There are question marks with that Blackburn spot in general. But David Peterson's been pretty damn good. Sean Manaea is tons of fun. What is, like, let's play this out where the Mets make the wild card and you can set it up how you would like. What does your 1-2-3 look like in a wild card series?
Wow, that is a soul searching question. I know Luis Severino is pitching. I know Sean Manaea is pitching.
Okay,
I gotta say, I don't know who is pitching game three.
Quintana, Peterson coin flip kind of thing.
Kinda. I mean, whoever kind of shows out over the next 4 or 5 weeks until that series would actually be taking place. I guess it's 4 weeks. We're really into September, huh?
Yeah, man.
I think that personally, I would rather see Peterson because I think that the upside is there. I think he has shown that he has earned that spot in the rotation. I've always been a Peterson defender against my better judgment, against what the stats say about soft contact, about expected runs, about the type of contact that he gets, and he has not been able to induce swing and miss much in his career, really, when he needs to. Although this season, he's had his career high in strikeouts, and then he's raised his career high in strikeouts multiple times throughout the season. And so you'd like to think that he's figuring something out there. I feel great about Severino and Manaea 1-2. Like, really good. Much better than I was expecting to heading into this season. But I don't love the way that Quintana can kind of fall off the rails early in a game, and then you're exposing your bullpen to whatever comes of it that day. And the Mets do not have the bullpen to be able to say, let's sweep up this mess. Certainly not in game three, where they already probably would have had to use their best guys one or even two times in a wild card series.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And I mean, Manaea is just like, seems like a fascinating dude and also just a fascinating career. So for him to now be in a spot where it's like, absolutely, I want him in a wild card game is, you know, how far, this is a guy who got bumped to the Giants bullpen last year when they were like, we don't actually have starting pitchers. We just have infinite Sean Manaea and Ross Stripling types back there. Okay, so you mentioned the bullpen is not as secure as maybe you would like. Welcome to every bullpen in baseball. But the back end, exactly, like with Reed Garrett and Phil Maton, Buto and Diaz, like, if things got to a seventh inning, is there a confidence level there, or has Diaz been too kind of up and down this year?
I mean, as confident as I would be with any normal major league bullpen, you know, like, which is to say
zero.
Not confident, yeah. You know, like at 5% maybe. Diaz has been good. You know, he has not been Edwin Diaz of 2 years ago, but who is? You know, very rarely do you see a player string together several seasons like that. He was clearly at a physical peak, at a mental peak. He's been knocked off of that peak a couple times this season. He lost the closing job for a couple weeks there, really just to get mechanical things more right. I don't think there was ever a question as to whether he would slot back into that closing job, but I feel good about Reed Garrett. Do I feel 100% confident in that? No, but I never feel 100% confident in a Major League Baseball reliever or a Major League Baseball starter. You know, it's not like we should just let Manaea go out there fourth, fifth time through the order. I think they're working with what they've got. Maton is the one who I'm trying not to let the voice in my head that's saying small sample size, the Rays cut bait on this guy. I'm trying not to let that voice win because he's looked really good. And it has seemed like he has had, you know, because he goes up there and he spins it pretty much every time. He throws curveballs and sliders pretty much all of the time. Every once in a while, he'll mix in a cutter just to change the eye level of the batter. You'd like to think that that will work, but that's the sort of thing that, like, taken in a larger sample, works very well. But in one inning in a wild card series that you need to win, if he's just not spinning it right and he can't get the ball over the plate, you could be serving up meatballs to a good team, you know, to Fernando Tatis Jr. And that would not feel good, you know? So I guess it wouldn't be Tatis Jr. most likely based on the way that the standings shake out. Sure. But you know what I mean.
Yeah. Here's the thing is the only thing I trust less than pitchers in the playoffs is hitters in the playoffs. So sure. There is just not a lot. Okay. Got a couple non-baseball ones for you before we let you go here. Know you're a big movie guy, chip in on the Big Picture podcast at The Ringer. TIFF is going on here. That's how you know it's playoff race season. Anything like what would be the top of your TIFF viewing list if you were here?
Well, I wish I was there. You know, I was thinking about trying to get up there, but I just dragged my feet too long
Mets,
on making
Blue
plans.
Jays and TIFF?
I know. I really dropped the ball on this one, Blake. But next year, I almost feel like if the Mets were in town when I was there, I would be too distracted by that. So maybe next year it'll be a clearer runway for me to make it up for TIFF. There's a couple obvious ones that I think people are really excited for. You know, Anora, the Sean Baker movie, has been tipped to potentially be a Best Picture contender. He, Sean Baker, a longtime indie director, who has a lot of very beloved movies in the 2010s. And Anora won the Palme d'Or at Cannes this year. So I think a lot of people have flagged it. Pretty much everybody seems to like it so far. I have not seen it yet. There's another movie called Conclave, which is about a papal conclave, but really is kind of really just about, I think, electoral politics. And that's two actors that I really like, Stanley Tucci and Ralph Fiennes. So I'm excited to see that kind of like thriller set within the context of a very, you know, specific setting like the Catholic Church. I think that pressure cookers like that make for good movies. Obligatory Canada shout, which is O Canada, the Paul Schrader movie, which I'm always excited to see a new Paul Schrader movie because he is just a guy who makes the exact movies that he wants to make. And I love that in movie making. And then if I was to go with an off the beaten path recommendation, or maybe not quite as obvious of a recommendation, there's a movie that I had just seen get put on the schedule at New York Film Festival, which I'll be covering over the next few weeks after TIFF ends, called Happy End, which is a feature debut from a director called Neo Sora. And it's supposed to take place in like the near future and feature themes of like tech surveillance and how you grow up under a tech surveillance state and how you still get to have that experience. And so those are all themes that I think appeal to me. So those would be four that I would recommend if you could take a look at. I know the tickets are kind of a hot item at this point.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a tough one. I appreciate the Tucci gang shout out, first of all, of course. The only one I'd add to that is, and this is like very specific to my sense of humor taste, is Friendship, the Tim Robinson, Paul Rudd, Kate Mara, very, apparently very, very dry comedy. I haven't seen it yet, but I had a friend see it yesterday and said, oh yeah, this is like so up your alley. It's okay. We only have a minute before I let you go here, but I told you I'd ask you as well, because this will probably be the last time we talk to you on the Jays Talk Plus season. Album of the year so far, since we started this off talking about music as well?
Can I cheat and say two? Yeah. Life Till Bones by Oso Oso. The man just writes hook after hook after hook after hook.
Go Knicks.
Pop, and it's indie, and it's rock, and it's so fun, but it's so humanistic. I love Oso Oso. Incredible album. And then a smaller shout, this album called Stay Golden by this Baltimore hardcore band called Combat, who I was not really up on much on their first couple EPs and stuff, but my co-host Alex, who is always like on every release, he was like, dude, album of the year, check it out. So it's called Stay Golden by Combat. It's incredibly high energy, super relatable, even though the people in the band are kind of like upsettingly young in comparison to you and I, Blake. But I really like that album. So Life Till Bones by Oso Oso and Stay Golden by Combat.
I think Oso Oso unofficially is probably the Jay's Talk Plus album of the year, just given the number of times I've played it coming back from commercial, or other people who have come on have the Oso Oso connection as well. And then, yeah, come Raptor season, maybe we'll bring him on to talk Knicks because, yeah, I believe he's a big Knicks guy as well. Bobby, thanks so much for taking the time out, man.
Thanks, Blake. It was great to talk to you, man.
Bobby Wagner of Tipping Pitches and The Ringer and The Big Picture, if you're a movie person there and want to keep up on everything going on at the New York Film Fest, which follows TIFF here. What follows tonight is the Jays against the Mets. We thought we knew the pitching matchups, but the Blue Jays have continued to not announce their starters ahead of time too far. It is supposed to be Chris Bassitt tonight and Bowden Francis tomorrow. That would be on their normal term plus an extra day of rest, so don't see why they'd change that up too much. Unless there's a Jake Bloss appearance coming, he would be on turn for tomorrow. Wednesday would be Kevin Gausman, but that's on normal rest, so maybe they bullpen it. We'll see. On the Mets side, it was supposed to be Paul Blackburn tonight. He's been scratched. It would be Tyler McGill. We thought it would be David Robertson and Sean Manaea the rest of the series. We'll see how that shakes out. No update from the Mets yet on the remainder of the series. Thank you to Shai Davidi, Lance Brzdowski, Craig Goldstein, and Bobby Wagner for joining us today. Thank you to Amit Mann, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. As always, it is 7:07. It's We Think Chris Bassitt against Tyler McGill, Jays Mets down at Rogers Center. Enjoy that one. We'll talk to you at 10 a.m. tomorrow. Have a wonderful Monday.